It's 1636, and you're living in Boston, which is basically a tiny town of a few thousand people. You're a Puritan, your neighbors are Puritans, all the ministers at church are Puritans, and even the entire town government is Puritan. You and all your neighbors are concerned with one question. Am I saved? And it's true that a lot of people are concerned about that today, but in a time when women could only expect half of their children to live past the age of 5, and when many women died just trying to give birth to those children, it only makes sense that the question, "Am I saved in the eyes of the Lord?" would get a lot of attention.
It's sort of like the modern concept of am I okay or am I happy. We've sort of replaced the Bible, which was the text of Puritan early American life, with all kinds of other media like television and the internet. But there's still this notion in modern life that you want to be, quote unquote, saved.
That's Eve LaPlante, author of American Jezebel. Her book explores the history of one Puritan who was deeply, deeply concerned about whether people were saved, and not just her and her family, but the entire Boston community. And that got her into a little bit of trouble, the kind of trouble that forced her and her entire family to walk across the frozen New England countryside in the dead of winter, moving toward an unknown fate, banished forever from the community where they were once welcomed with open arms. That dangerous Puritan? Her name was Anne Hutchinson.
If you were in Boston in New England in, say, 1636 and 1637, and you went on a Thursday or a Tuesday night to Anne Hutchinson's parlor, apparently what we've read is that there would have been 60 or 80 people crowding in. She would be seated in a chair, usually in a Puritan home in early New England. There was one chair, it was the man's chair. And next to her would be Henry Vane, the young governor, and several of the judges, the magistrates of the general court, would be there with their wives because their wives would have gone home and told their husbands about this remarkable woman who was interpreting the Bible. And she would have the Bible open in front of her and be moving around in pages and interpreting things and explaining God's grace to them.
And they laid hands upon them and put them in hold unto the next day, for it was now
evening time. And explaining why the things that they might have heard in the meeting house the last week were misinterpretations of God's true message and what God's true message was.
Did you catch all the things that weren't typical for the 1630s? Anne Hutchinson wasn't a typical woman. You have to imagine her as a kind of 17th century Oprah Winfrey. She was incredibly popular and incredibly good at addressing a crowd. She got a huge following, especially for a woman in the 1630s. Anne Hutchinson was born in England, the daughter of a rebellious minister who at one point lost his post and was put under house arrest because he disagreed with the Church of England. He taught Anne to interpret the Bible and to preach, which in itself was a little unusual, but Anne was a natural.
She was a very brilliant, obviously brilliant young girl, and it must have been very exciting for her father, the Reverend Francis Marbury, to have such a brilliant child to teach.
Anne grows up, she gets married to a wealthy merchant, and she starts going to church to see this really compelling preacher named John Cotton. And when I say compelling...
John Cotton was the Mick Jagger of Puritan England. He was a real hotshot. And when he spoke, people really listened, like for 5 hours if he wanted to sermonize.
Anne is totally transfixed by Cotton. She started spreading his message to neighboring towns, bringing more people to hear him speak. And she's good at it. By the time Cotton says he's heading for New England to teach and preach, Anne has become his right-hand woman. She and her family eventually follow Cotton to Boston. Let's talk about Boston for a second. Actually, hold on. Let's go downtown to the exact spot where Anne Hutchinson and her family settled in 1634.
We're standing in downtown Boston on Washington Street. It's very bustling. There are all these construction projects and cranes. We're in front of the site of Anne Hutchinson's house, which is a building that was built in brick in the early 18th century on the exact foundation of the wooden house that Anne Hutchinson built in 1634 when she and her husband, a wealthy merchant, arrived in Boston with their large family.
And now it's a Chipotle.
Now it's a Chipotle. Yeah. This was prime real estate where we're standing now. This is where all of the wealthiest, you know, most high status families lived. This was a village, and these were wooden houses, many of them with they all would have had thatched roofs. Some of them were very nice, like with second floors, and Anne Hutchinson had like 12 children living here.
Anne Hutchinson lived right next door to all of the most prominent men of the town. John Cotton lived near modern-day Government Center, and John Winthrop, the former governor of Massachusetts, a well-respected and influential man, lived just around the corner. Life was pretty good for the Puritans, especially when you compare it to life in England.
In England, they were the Puritan minority. They were getting in trouble. They were going under house arrest. They were being silenced. Here in New England, they were creating this perfect society that was Puritan, and they were grabbing as many hundreds of acres, thousands of acres of land as they could, and trying to hold power. And for Winthrop, they were trying to make a government that would last.
Winthrop is the man who described his vision for the new American colony as a city upon a hill.
So he really didn't want anyone to mess up his creation.
But he had dealt with a lot of dissent in his years as governor. He also worried that a divided colony could be attacked by the French, the Spanish, or the Dutch. So Anne Hutchinson's dissension doesn't just threaten the order of things in the colony, it threatens the survival of the colony itself. When Winthrop discovers that the new governor, Henry Vane, is one of the many prominent men hanging around the Hutchinson household, listening to a woman preach that the town ministers are wrong, that they're interpreting the Bible poorly, that they're no better than the Church of England, that really gets him going. The men who led the government backed the men who led the church, and vice versa. To criticize one was to criticize the other. What Anne Hutchinson is doing amounts to outright contempt for both the church and the government.
They came here for religious freedom, and they immediately created a world in which only people exactly like them were free, and everybody else was the outcast.
Hutchinson was accused of sedition, and in 1637, she was brought before the general court to answer for her crimes. Deputy Governor Thomas Dudley described the situation for the court.
"About 3 years ago, we were all in peace. Then Mistress Hutchinson, from that time she came, hath made a disturbance. She had vented divers of her strange opinions, and had made parties in the country. And Mistress Hutchinson hath so forestalled the minds of many by their resort to her meetings, that now she hath a potent party in the country."
The court wants Anne Hutchinson to renounce her teachings, to admit that it's wrong for her to teach such a large party of men and women, to recant her criticisms of the ministers, and go back to the right role for women. As the trial wears on, it becomes clear that Anne won't do any of that. In fact, the trial is the best platform she's ever had.
She and Winthrop are battling over whether she is allowed to teach people, and she's finding scriptural justification for her teaching of younger women. And then Winthrop corrects her, saying,
"Elder women must instruct them about their business to love their husbands and not to make them clash."
In the Apostles, a married couple, a man and a woman, took upon them to instruct a man named Apollos more perfectly. He was a man of good parts, but they, better instructed, might teach him.
See how your argument stands? Priscilla, with her husband, took Apollos to her home to instruct him privately. Therefore, Mistress Hutchinson, without her husband, may teach 60 or 80?
I call them not, but if they come to me, I may instruct them.
Yet you show us not a rule.
I've given you two places of scripture.
But neither of them will suit your practice.
Must I show my name written therein?
Hutchinson might have felt good about herself right then. She might have felt like she was winning a rhetorical argument, something she was really, really good at doing. But the more she fought, the stronger the argument against her became. The more she succeeded at poking holes in the case, the more she looked like a threat to the civil order. At this point, Winthrop must have been seething, but he didn't necessarily have a reason to banish Hutchinson. That came when Hutchinson claimed to get direct revelations from God. That constituted blasphemy and was grounds for banishment. Eventually, even her friend John Cotton had to abandon her cause in order to save his own reputation and status in Boston.
If Anne Hutchinson had been alive 10 or 15 or 20 years later, she would have been hanged. This notion that a woman or anyone really has a right to free speech, has a right to independent conscience, has a right to believe what they believe religiously or in any other way, this was not acceptable in early New England.
John Winthrop, pleased with how he had put down a nasty dissident in his midst, sent the transcripts of the trial off to England in an attempt to show how well the Puritans were governing the young colony.
It was sort of a public relations move that they kept these transcripts, and if they hadn't, we would know nothing about Anne Hutchinson and nothing about what she believed or what kind of trouble she caused. And it would have actually made John Winthrop look better if he hadn't done that.
The only record we have of most 17th century women is the day they were born, the day they were married, and the day they died, all written into the parish records. If Hutchinson kept a diary, it was never preserved. We have no letters, no portraits. Hutchinson might have been left in total obscurity if her next move hadn't been so remarkable.
When she was banished in 1637 and then cast out of the church in 1638, she and her family went south to Rhode Island. They actually founded the settlement of Rhode Island in 1638. They actually walked, Anne Hutchinson and about 60 of her followers, family members, she was pregnant at the time with what would have been her 16th child. They walked to Rhode Island from Boston. It took 6 days in thigh-deep snow.
Rhode Island was already home to another dissenter, Roger Williams. Williams founded Providence, and the Hutchinsons founded Portsmouth. Ultimately, the two towns were combined into the colony of Rhode Island. Anne Hutchinson's name doesn't appear on any of the founding documents because, as a woman, she couldn't sign legal papers. Her husband and son signed instead. But today, Anne Hutchinson is recognized as the only woman who founded an American colony. She lived in Rhode Island for 4 years. Her beloved husband died, which was a terrible blow for her. But eventually she moved with some of her children to Dutch New Amsterdam, in what is today New York State.
She lived there in a farmhouse along what's now the Hutchinson River for about a year. And then in the midst of a battle between the natives, Indians there, the Siwanoy Indians and the Dutch, she and her family were massacred and scalped, and all of the cattle and the bodies of the people were put into her house and the house was burned down.
But Anne Hutchinson's legacy lives on. Her surviving children bore many, many descendants. Numbered among them are both Presidents Bush, Mitt Romney, several Supreme Court justices, and Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
You look at the 2004 presidential race, George Bush was running against John Kerry. George Bush is a Hutchinson descendant. John Kerry is a Winthrop descendant. So these battles of the, you know, the first half of the 17th century in New England are in some way still being played out.
Eve LaPlante is also a descendant of Anne Hutchinson. She sees Hutchinson's legacy in her genealogy and in the struggle for representation of women in American political life.
While we think on the surface that men and women are equal in America, we have now 20% of our elected legislators in Congress are female, and we're viewing this as a positive sign. We've reached, after almost 400 years, 20% representation for half the population. And in her story, you can see the sort of beginnings of this 400-year story of women not having public power in the United States of America. And she's just the first chapter in that lack of public power that women have.
LaPlante says that if Anne Hutchinson were alive today, she probably wouldn't be a feminist. She was much more focused on religion, salvation, and God than any political struggle here on Earth. What makes Anne Hutchinson's story exceptional is that she, as a woman with no power and no rights, stood up to the establishment and spoke what she felt to be the absolute truth. And when you think about it, what's more American than that? This podcast is a production of the Commonwealth Museum, www.commonwealthmuseum.org. Today's podcast was produced and edited by Anna Pinkert. Additional voices by
T. Hopkins, Dwayne Lehman, and Abby Maxson Carter.
Special thanks to Eve LaPlante and to WUMB. Our executive producer is Stephen Kenny.